My father and myself had a client over in Ava County named Zeke Garland. Zeke was about 6 feet, 7 inches tall, I would say. He'd made a great basketball player now, because he just have to stoop down to drop the ball through the basket. He had taken out one of the early policies of hospital insurance. And he became ill and went to the hospital, and when he got out, the insurance company refused to pay his claim on the ground that he had made a false statement and practiced fraud in applying for the policy. And his statement consisted of an answer he gave to a question whether he'd ever suffered an accident. We tried the case before a jury up in Avery County, and Mr. W.M. Hendren of Winston-Salem was defending the case, and he was a very fine lawyer, and so he was cross-examining Zeke, and he presented the application Zeke had made for the policy in a certain question 5, we'll say. And he asked Zeke, he didn't sign that application if he hadn't filled in the answer to question 5 in his own handwriting, and he said he had. And the question was, have you ever suffered an accident? And the answer was written in Zeke's handwriting, no. Then Mr. Hendren asked him, said, well, Mr. Garland, prior to the time you applied for this policy, hadn't you been bitten by a rattlesnake? And Zeke said, yes, I had. And Mr. Hendren said, don't you call that an accident? He said, no, sir, said the damn thing bit me on purpose. It's impossible to over-magnify the importance of friendship. It's pretty hard to let a friend down when he shows that he's got faith in you and is willing to stand by you. The closest friend I had in growing up was a boy named Charles Lane who lived here in Morgan. He and I were inseparable and shared the same thoughts. One of my other great friends was fellow Dick Mitchell who lived here in Morgan. Dick was a good deal older than I was. He was our county sheriff at one time. He's about 6 feet and 4 inches tall and scared of nothing. And I don't think I ever had a more loyal friend than Dick. I think if I was some far corner of the earth and sent him a cablegram or a telegram that I needed him, that he would have come immediately without even stopping to inquire why I needed him. When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I'll dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get rough and friends just can't be found. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. When you're down and out, when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I will take your part. Oh, when darkness comes and pain is all around, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. I will lay me down. In other words, I think if we have a fault at this time, it is a fault of conformity. We've had an effort to make people think the same things and make everybody think the same things, entertain the same views, support the same laws, the same legislative proposals. And I found that when my own children were going through school, they wanted to conform. And I had one daughter that she got awful poor grades, and I knew she could do a whole lot better, and I remonstrated with her, and she said, "Well, Dad, I just don't want to make any better grades. Said they'll think I'm a brain." And that was made of an odd character, and I think that that has been a rather unfortunate thing in modern times, this idea of conformity. Because I think the strongest people we have are people that carry their own sovereignty under their own hats, and if they wear hats anymore, and they used to say in the old days, and they think their own thoughts. I think it's essential for young people to be encouraged to participate in politics. For I think young people have an enthusiasm, which we need, and also I think they have an idealism, which we need. And I think the worst thing could happen would be for young people to just refrain from participation in politics. I'm not one that's troubled too much about the young people in the country. I get around and talk to a lot of college students, and I find them very refreshing. They're interested in so many things. They discuss just about anything with very little inhibitions. They seem to be intellectually honest, and I think the country's going to be in pretty good shape when they take over. I think that we have too many people who do not have a code of ethics which restrains them from committing unethical acts and even illegal acts. I think that perhaps we've had too much emphasis on success. I don't know how you can correct this kind of a situation. And I've thought that Southerners have a certain peculiarity due to the fact that all of their greatest heroes were men who failed. In other words, the greatest heroes of Southerners are men like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart and those who followed them. These men failed in their objective. And the fact that they failed in their objective, I think, teaches some of us that the truth that's embodied in a little poem by Edwin Markham. Because to me, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart and their followers exemplified in their lives and in their deaths the truth stated in this little poem. The poem says, "Defeat may serve as well as victory to shake the soul and let the glory out." And I think we need more of that spirit in this country, that success is not the important thing, it's what you do. And how you try to win success, whether you try to win it by fair means rather than foul, and also that if you do not win success, that if you fight for your cause with valor, that the defeat that you may suffer will shake the soul and let the glory out, as well as victory will, and perhaps better. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise, if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve their turn long after they are gone, And so hold on when there's nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiven minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. That's a great poem. I think about the most important thing that a parent can do is to try to furnish some inspiration to the children, because the greatest responsibility we have is trying to train up a child in the way in which he should go. As my father used to quote that, he said, the Bible says, train up a child in the way in which he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart therefrom. He said he will depart many times during his youth. This poem entitled Grow Tall, My Son is a very fine poem, and one well designed to encourage a son to develop as he should. Grow tall, my son. Hold your head up high when you say goodbye to your youth. Grow tall, my son. Let your heart be meek, and let the words you speak be the truth. Find time in your life to walk by the sea, to look up at a tree, to hold a child on your knee. And grow tall, my son. Give your all, my son, as you live each day and night. For even the small grow tall in God's sight. We had a chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy here. The perennial chairman of the organization was one of my kin folks, Cousin Sue Tate. Cousin Sue never bothered to get a program until just about 15 minutes before the meeting was to occur. And one Monday night, when I had been in court all day and on a case that was going to take several more days, she called me just before midnight and said that she wanted me to come to the dinner meeting the UDC was having the next night and make a speech on Jefferson Davis. I said, look here, Cousin Sue, you asking me to come and make a speech on Jefferson Davis tomorrow night? I've been in court all day today. Here it is midnight on Monday night, and I got to be in court all day tomorrow. I just can't do it. I wouldn't have time to think what I should say about Jefferson Davis. Cousin Sue said, well, I'm not going to take no for an answer. Said, in the first place, any good Southerner ought to be able to make a speech on Jefferson Davis at any time and in any place on any occasion without any preparation. And in the second place, you don't need any time to think what you should say about Jefferson Davis. Said, I've heard you speak, and I know you speak without thinking. The First Amendment, I think, is the heart of the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for a redress of grievances. In other words, there was a charter of political freedom, a charter of intellectual freedom, and a charter of spiritual freedom. I think that the First Amendment is the only thing that really makes our system of government work. In other words, it's based on the theory that a republic such as ours demands the freest and the fullest flow of information. And it's based fundamentally on the proposition which Jefferson almost enunciated. He certainly suggested, but didn't quite express, but I think it'd be stated this way, that a nation has nothing to fear from freedom of speech as long as it leaves truth free to combat error. There was an old mountain couple, John and Mandy, who lived in a cabin on the mountain out on what we call the Asheville-Murphy branch of the Southern Railroad. All of their boys and girls had grown up and had married off and had established homes of their own, leaving John and Mandy alone as they were in the beginning of their married life. They had always had an ambition to own what they called a striking clock. And so after their last child had married and left them, they saved up their money from their butter and eggs and from his occasional runs of moonshine liquor. When they thought they had enough money to buy the striking clock for which they'd been longing all of those years, they went down and caught the train into Asheville. On their arrival in Asheville, they visited various jewelry shops until at long last they found the very kind of striking clock that they'd been longing for all of these years. Fortunately, they had enough money to pay cash for the clock. It was quite a large instrument, but they were so determined to get the clock back that John carried it on his shoulder. They went to the railroad station and took the train back home. And when they got to the foot of the mountain, while John struggled and carried the clock up the mountain and set it up in their cabin, John and Mary decided by mutual consent that the clock struck so pretty that they would sit up all night and hear the clock strike. They decided to be ashamed for the clock to strike and nobody to hear the pretty tones it made. So they sat up all night to hear the clock strike. Well, the next night, Mandy said she just didn't feel able to sit up a second night, and John said, well, it's just a shame for nobody to hear the clock when it strikes so pretty, so suppose you go to bed and sleep tonight, Mandy, and I'll stay up and listen to the clock strike tonight. And tomorrow night, you can sit up and listen to the clock strike, and I'll get some sleep. So Mandy went to bed, and John sat up and listened to the clock strike hour after hour. The clock was entirely regular in its operations until the hour midnight came. And then the clock struck 12, but it didn't stop when it struck 12. It struck 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 and 18 and kept on striking. This alarmed John very much, and he jumped up and ran and shook Mandy, said, Mandy, get up. We got to get out of here. It's later than I've ever known it to be. I have found times when you have a strong temptation to cast a political vote because it's politically popular, which you know is wrong. I sort of keep myself in the straight and narrow legislative path by quoting this little verse. I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. I don't want to stand at the setting sun and hate myself for the things I've done. Well, I think we all have a purpose here. I think life is a great adventure, and it's great to belong to the grand old pageant of man. I've been impressed by the fact that the great majority of people are essentially good. And despite all our theological doctrines of the Calvinists about the evil in the human heart, I think that the average person prefers to live a good life rather than an evil life. I have faith in a supreme being. I don't believe that we were created by blind atoms wandering aimlessly about in chaos. And I believe that there are some truths that we cannot pry open or explain, that we got to accept on faith. That after all, the faith is the thing that lets us walk in those areas that lie outside the bounds of human thought. I think that the greatest relationship with life is marriage. And unfortunately, all marriages are not for keeps, but the ideal marriage is for keeps. I'm very happy that I've had the same girl walking beside me for 49 years, and she's never made a misstep, you know, all that time. She was from Concord. Her name was Margaret Bell. I guess I'd say I fell in love with her at first sight, and I've been in that condition ever since. She's always been there when I needed her the most, which has been always. She has an uncanny capacity, or you might call it an intuition, to distinguish between what is good and what is bad and what is wise and what is foolish and what is important and what is insignificant. If I've done any good, why, she's largely, almost entirely responsible for it. I was asked some time ago to say what her predominant traits were, and I said, you know, I don't know how you can talk about anybody much that's perfect, because you've got all the desirable qualities.